Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Hi, I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben.
And we're from Car Stuff.
We're the podcast that covers everything that floats, flies, swims, or drives. Adventures, thrills, chills, literally planes, trains, and automobiles.
That's right. And you can find all of our episodes on Google Play, Spotify, iTunes, and really anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
There is, gentle reader, nothing the works of God only set apart, which so much beautifies and adorns the soul and mind of man, as does knowledge of the good arts and sciences. Many arts there are which beautify the mind of man, but of all, none do more garnish and beautify it than those arts which are called mathematical, unto the knowledge of which no man can attain without perfect knowledge and instruction of the principles, grounds, and elements of geometry.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And my name is Christian Sager. And if last episode sounded like we were invoking a ritual to summon angels or demons, this sounds like we are teaching AP calculus.
Yeah, those are the words of Dr. John Dee. Those are from his preface, his mathematical preface to the 1570 translation of Euclid's Elements. Now, at this point, we should mention that if you did not listen to our previous episode on John Dee, you definitely need to go back to that one.
Yeah.
Because that is the episode where we really dove into his timeline and discussed in broad strokes the major events of his life.
Yeah. We also focused on the sort of magical occult aspects of John Dee's beliefs and life in that episode. This episode, we're really going to focus on his scientific education, his ability with mathematics, how he participated in statecraft in England and, in fact, advocated for expanding the British Empire, and especially developed cryptography as we know it today.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, in that even though, you know, in a sense the last episode was magic and this one is the science, this is more rooted in the real world, John Dee was not so firmly rooted. He seemed to live simultaneously in the mathematical and the magical world. He did not really see a division. Like, like the spiritual, the mathematical, the magic. It was all part of the world as he perceived it.
Yeah, so get ready. As we're talking about this stuff, it may seem like, oh, we're going over some historical science here, and then all of a sudden, you know, Merlin will pop up, or maybe some angelic influence here or there.
Yeah, now it's really important to note here, too, though, that as unique as Dee was, this mixing of magic and math, the suspicion of math even, was not unique to him. It was very much a part of the day. Mathematics was regarded in some circles with suspicion at the time. During the Tudor era, mathematical books were sometimes burned as alleged conjuring books. This according to 17th century antiquarian John Aubrey. And it was still very much associated with the dark arts. I mean, you have to think of Pythagoras.
Yeah.
Key in the history of mathematics, was also considered a magician. Numbers had inherent powers. And this is a theme that ran through the works of Kepler, Newton, Euclid, and others. So there was a long tradition of mathematics and magic kind of sharing the same space.
One of the things that I read was that mathematics were considered disreputable and connected to witchcraft because they were associated with numerology. And I mentioned this in the last episode, the Jewish mystical tradition of the Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about the cryptography stuff in a minute, but Trithemius, who wrote the book that Dee really worked off of to create his version of cryptography, that guy was also suspected of wizardry. So this had a long-standing tradition. Dee, for his part, though, in terms of mathematics, his lectures on Euclid were wildly popular, as he was seen as a leading scientific figure of his day. I'm picturing that he's like the Neil deGrasse Tyson, right? Like he's giving lectures. Everybody's really interested. These lectures earned him an offer to join the faculty at the Sorbonne in Paris in 1551. We mentioned that real briefly last time, but he turned stuff like this down because he was hoping to obtain an official position with the English crown. He was also, Robert read from this at the beginning, but it's worth pointing out, the editor of the first English translation of Euclid's Elements. And in that, he added his preface, which what Robert read came from. This preface argued for the usefulness of mathematics. Like, people didn't regard mathematics as being important at that time. And in fact, this was the first time the public were introduced to the symbols plus, minus, x for multiply, and the little dot, dash dot for division.
Yeah, in this preface, the mathematical preface, he proposed, An arts mathematical that he compared to thaumaturgy, which is the use of magic for religious purposes. So he saw mathematics rather than magic as the key to thaumaturgical wonder. Men's work could rival the gods if they could utilize mathematics correctly.
Mm.
And in this, you know, you could say Dee was correct. I mean, we may disagree on whether math is a human invention or a human discovery, but it has thus far proven to correspond to the inner workings of the cosmos. It's our best tool, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
He saw this reflected in the creation of automatons, those of Albertus Magnus and others, all these various mechanical devices that mimicked the appearance of life and the movement and the willfulness of life. And in fact, that's where that his FX work in 1546 comes into play. That's what he was essentially dabbling in.
Yeah, we talked about this in the last episode. Mm-hmm. He apparently created this giant automaton. Reportedly, it was a mechanical flying beetle. I don't know if it actually flew or not, but apparently it was so impressive that people thought that it was magic.
Yeah, and that was very much in keeping with his view of what math was and what science was capable of doing, that it could replicate the wonders of nature by manipulating the same properties. And he saw things like automatons and even his own special effects work as proof of that. He saw the optics of his special mirror, his kind of reverse mirror.
Oh, yeah.
That he would wow people with. He saw that as an example of, look, these amazing feats are possible through optics, through mathematics, through science.
And ultimately, his mathematics led to him advocating for the expansion of the British Empire. And he reportedly is the one who coined the term British Empire.
Yeah, which is crazy. It's also, it's, sometimes you forget. Like, it's hard to think back to a time where the British Empire wasn't a thing, not only in actuality, but even in concept.
Yeah.
So we're traveling back to 1577 here, and this is kind of what was going on at the time. Sir Francis Drake was preparing for an epic voyage around the globe. Walsingham's spies had exposed another plot against the British crown, and Dee had noted a significant problematic comet amid the meaning saturated stars. And on November 28th, amid all of these excitements, Dee comes and he proposes this concept, this idea to the Queen of England that she should challenge Spain's imperial claim to the New World.
Yeah, and a lot of this was based around, how do I put this? So on top of being a brilliant mathematician, he was able to apply that to cartography.
Yes.
And mapping out routes or understanding the geography of the New World.
Yeah, it's... You mentioned cartographers here. We'd mentioned in the past episode that he'd learned from and was in correspondence with noted cartographer Gerardus Mercator.
Yeah,
and Mercator is apparently the guy who filled him in about this idea that that there was a precedence for the British Empire set by a legendary incursion into the northern indrawing seas around the pole by King Arthur in the year 530.
Yeah.
Lands that had hence been claimed by Iberian nations.
This is where he got the whole idea, he being Dee, got the whole idea for him being the modern day Merlin and Elizabeth being the modern day Arthur. He actually presented Elizabeth with a treatise on Britain's imperial limits at one point, and it suggested that the Americas had actually been discovered by King Arthur centuries before.
Yeah, and also that the British Empire was already a thing. This concept is not something that England could claim for itself, but reclaim. This was part of its identity already.
Yeah. So you might be wondering, what's a courtier anyways, right? So a lot of people, when they're describing Dee, they just say, well, he's a courtier. I don't know what that means. Apparently, it is a man that is concerned with the operation of the royal court and, by extension, the kingdom of which it was an effective ruling body. So it was in his interests to make sure that the ruling body of Britain expanded.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the court as well, because the court at the time was lavish and, you know, rather impressive to behold. But at the same time, it was horribly in debt. The English military was weak. The political condition was far from stable. England was a relatively poor nation. And the idea of challenging Spain, Imperial Spain, in such a manner was highly ambitious, if not outright ridiculous. Remember, at the time there was a papal bull dividing the Americas between the Spanish and the Portuguese. So it wasn't just that England should challenge Spain; it was that England should challenge the papacy's division of the globe. This was not just, hey, we're pretty awesome, we should go over and claim this. It's like, no, this involves a leveling up,
right,
of the nation that might not be practical.
And it worked.
Yeah.
And for his part, the way that Dee assisted was with his knowledge of cartography and mathematical modeling. So he instructed captains and pilots in the principles of mathematical navigation. He would prepare maps for their use, and he furnished them with various navigational instruments. In the 1550s, he actually advised Richard Chancellor's expedition through the North Sea so that he could establish a trade route between England and Moscow. And there's some evidence that Dee was, financially involved in that as well. Like he had something to gain from this trade route. In 1572, a new star appeared, and it was visible for 17 months. Now, today, we know that this was a supernova in the constellation Cassiopeia. Dee saw this as the signal for the beginning of the English Protestant Empire. And so he also instructed an expedition to discover the Northwest Passage to China in 1576. Now, I've talked a lot about Northwest Passages before, or the Northwest Passage and expeditions through it before on the show, because I've done research on it in the past. You know, like almost all of these, it was totally fruitless. But it did lead to English settlements in Canadian North America. And this is where it gets crazy. Dee formed his own company to colonize the Americas, and there's some evidence that he was the intellectual force behind Francis Drake's circumnavigation of the globe. And Dee would be awarded rights to any newly discovered land that was north of the 50th parallel if Drake had gone any further north than Oregon. This basically would have given him all of Canada.
Oh, wow.
So Dee would have, like, if this had all worked out, Dee would own Canada.
How different might Canadian history be if it had been founded by a wizard?
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, we talked about this in the last episode. You know, Dee moved his family to Krakow, Poland in 1583. A lot of it had to do with the whole, angelic communication thing and Lasky and Kelly, as we previously described. But some believed that the whole reason he was there was actually to act as a spy. And when Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II suspected Dee, that's when he was banished from the empire. And he went to a small town called Trebon in what at the time was southern Bohemia. I imagine now it's probably part of the Czech Republic or maybe Slovakia. But this is fascinating. That's what gets him kicked out when, as we know from last episode, he just basically went up to Rudolf and was like, "Hey, angels told me you're possessed by demons." And Rudolf was like, "Eh, whatever." But, then he's like, "Maybe this guy's a spy," and he gets rid of him. Now here's a really fun fact. Are you ready, everybody? Dee signed his letters to Elizabeth as 007.
Yeah, a secret sign, a cipher that at least looked like 007.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm wondering if that's where, Ian Fleming got the idea for 007 from, or if it's maybe an actual, it has a historical precedent.
So I've read two different versions of this. One is that Ian Fleming was reading about John Dee at the time and directly got this, this idea from Dee's writings.
Okay.
And I've also read some people that cast doubt on this whole connection and say that, oh, well, actually, John Dee didn't really use 007. So I'm not sure exactly where the truth lies there.
Somewhere in the middle.
But we will get back to this whole spying thing, this whole espionage thing, because as incredible as everything has been thus far, it really gets crazier in the episode where we're not even talking about angelic communication all that much. Right.
Okay, why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we're going to talk about the cryptography aspects of Dee's career.
What happens to our digital lives when we're gone? Could our online personalities be brought back to life? What could artificial intelligence do when combined with saved digital memories? A new podcast from GE Podcast Theater in Panoply, the creators of last year's award-winning The Message, explores those very questions. The story follows Ross Barnes, a low-level employee at the FBI who spends his days conversing online with his wife, Charlie, who died 8 months ago. But the technology behind this digital resurrection leads Ross down a dangerous path that threatens his job, his own life, and maybe even the world. The title of the series is Life After. That's all one word. It's 10 episodes in length. Listen, subscribe, and download it today. All right, we're back. So cryptography, the study, the creation, and the breaking of codes and ciphers.
Yeah, so we've already covered this slightly, but Dee was taken with the work of German abbot Trithemius, and he was an important figure in the history of cryptography as well as occultism. And in 1564, while Dee was in Antwerp, he tracked down a copy of Trithemius's most famous work, the Steganographia, and copied it. Now, you were telling me that there is this like whole weird thing about the copying of it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's pretty strange. So certainly Trithemius was a big deal. Again, important figure in the history of cryptography and occultism. And Dee was already a fan. He owned several copies of his book, Polygraphia, which was the first printed book about the subject of cryptography.
Not to say, you know, certainly not the first book. It's also worth noting that there was an Arabic book that was already out there in the world. And this book was by a man by the name of Al-Kindi. But this was the first that was, you know, certainly the first Western tome mm-hmm. dealing with cryptography. There were 12 rotating paper cipher disks embedded within the pages. And even today, they're in remarkably good condition. They still turn. So it was a pretty pretty phenomenal book.
I'm kind of thinking of, I don't think you've seen this movie yet, but that Doctor Strange movie came out.
Oh, I've seen it. Yeah.
Oh, you saw it? Yeah. You know the library in that? That's what I'm imagining.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, and certainly there's a lot of like circular devices and glyphs that should pop up in that movie that feel right at home in the world of John Dee, except not glowing and spinning in the air.
Right.
Unless you're talking to Edward Kelly, and he'll say, yeah, I can see those discs probably. So he finds out there's a copy of Steganographia out there, which was a rare book. It was essentially an abandoned work of Trithemius's because it dealt with, at least on the surface, dealt with angelic communication. It dealt with communing with spirits and using spirits to relay messages over vast distances.
Okay, hold on a second. I think I've got a theory here. Let's see if this plays out as we're talking more about Trithemius. What if, so we know that Dee was really into Trithemius and that he gathered all of this information before he met Edward Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
What if Edward Kelly was using Trithemius to create his version of Enochian that eventually Dee wrote down and hearkened as the angelic language?
Yeah.
Maybe that's it.
It sounds compelling to me. I guess I should probably say a little more about Trithemius before I go any further here. But this guy alone was pretty fascinating. This was the man who served as advisors to emperors, was among the most erudite German book collectors of his time, author of more than 50 books himself, and the founder of scientific bibliography. He was, as previously noted, the first printed author on the subject of cryptography in the West, and yet then here's this book that seems to be devoted to angelic magic that he was forced to abandon writing because he was talking to other people about it. And they were like, ooh, I don't know about this book you're working on, Trithemius. Even as he was writing it, he made claims that the text would enable communication over vast distances, to communicate one's thoughts by fire, and other claims. So basically, like other individuals hearing about this, they were like, well, this makes it sound like either you're lying,
right,
or you're a demonic sorcerer, right?
Neither of which are smiled upon.
not so much in the church. So the crazy thing is that over the centuries, it's been revealed that all three volumes of this work are concerned with cryptography. And most recently, volume 3. So pretty early on, commentators figured out, all right, well, these first two books are only like surface level about angelic magic. They're really about cryptography and codes and ciphers. But they thought for the longest, well, this third book, though, this just seems to be about magic. There's no code here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a fitting read for the life of John Dee. The idea of like, at what point does the magic become the main thing?
Right.
But here's the crazy part. This view of the third book of Steganographia only lasted until the late 1990s.
Okay.
That's when two individuals experienced unrelated breakthroughs in cracking it. German linguist Thomas Ernst and Jim Reeds, who was working in the mathematics and cryptography research department at AT&T.
So AT&T paid for somebody to research this old book on angelic communication and cryptography.
Well, I don't know if he did. I'm not certain if he did this part on the AT&T dime.
Oh, okay.
But Reeds is a guy who's subsequently written a few different books on this and other D-related works. he wrote about this particular work in 1998, summing it up with the following, which is, I think, rather illuminating as we continue to look at Dee's obsessions. Quote, "The question now is, why did Trimetheus so thoroughly embrace the rhetoric of magic for such a non-magical, as we regard it, purpose? Did he regard cryptography as inherently magical? Or was his choice of the language a solution to the stylistic problem that all authors of cryptographic exposition have to solve? How to sustain the reader's interest through example after example of usually tedious plain texts, possibly tedious explanations of cryptographic techniques, and always tedious cipher texts? Trimetheus's use of angel language might thus be a rhetorical strategy to engage the reader's interest. If so, he was vastly successful, even if he completely miscalculated how his book would be received." Because this basically, like I said, that he was an important figure in occult circles.
Yeah.
Because for the longest, like, that's what these books look like. That's what those books mean if you're not breaking the code and sort of finding the deeper symbolism, the deeper purpose of the text.
Yeah. So he's thinking along the lines of, I'm going to write this really groundbreaking piece of linguistic science, but that's not really sexy, so I'll tell everyone it's about angels.
Yeah, or it's like it's kind of think about it like this. If you have a grammar lesson,
yeah,
what kind of sentence are you going to use? You're going to use a boring sentence or an exciting one?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So in a sense, he used the exciting sentence. He put a dog in his sentence.
Another theory. And yeah. Again, I'm no Dee scholar, and I know there's lots of people out there who have poured through his diaries, but maybe Dee was doing the same thing.
Well, that becomes the crazy thing to try and figure out. Like,
yeah.
what were Dee's interests here? Was he interested in the magic?
Yeah.
Was he interested in clearly he was interested in cryptography.
Yeah.
He'd read his other book. That's why he sought out this one.
There was the whole wife swapping thing, though. So there is a certain amount of him actually believing angels are telling him to do things he doesn't want to do.
It makes one think, like, at what point in studying cryptography through the language of magic do you become kind of ensorcelled by the magic,
yeah,
by the language of the,
yeah,
of magic? Yeah, it's crazy. Now back to this whole expedition where he ends up finding this copy of this rare book. So as Benjamin Woolley points out in his book, this was no small accomplishment. It was a really difficult book to steal a peek at. It was banned. It was actually the church had placed it on the index Librorum Prohibitorum in 1609, and it remained there until 1900.
Huh.
So this was a banned book.
Yeah.
This was like a dark book.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's black magic.
Yeah, this is a dangerous text. So Dee had to spend money to travel. He probably had to pay bribes, and he worked with a mysterious nobleman of Hungary who required that Dee in turn, quote, pleasure him with such points of science as he requireth.
That sounds filthy. I hope it's not. Maybe he was just like performing scientific tricks, like, I don't know, fire. Ooh, like.
Or it kind of sounds like you have, like in this case with the nobleman of Hungary, kind of like, yeah, a rich science fanboy,
yeah,
who has access to something amazing and then therefore uses it and as an excuse to make the real scientist / magician hang out with him.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And then on top of this, so, I mean, Dee's whole thing was not only to look at it, not only to read it, but to copy it. So he would have his own copy.
Okay.
And this was a difficult book to copy because it's full of tables and charts, moving parts, apparently meaningless names, angelic language. And, he only had 10 days to get it all copied down, likely with this Hungarian guy.
Just standing over
his shoulder. Standing over him the whole time, trying to make small talk.
Oh, wow. And you really feel for John Dee when you dive into the details here, you know? I mean, yeah, he wasn't the greatest guy in the world. He did, you know, make his young wife sleep with his scryer at one point. But he really seemed to be doing his best to try to gather this information up for the benefit of, I guess, like, as he saw it, mankind.
Yeah, yeah, I increasingly sympathize with Dee through all of these adventures and misadventures. Increasingly more misadventures than adventures.
Right.
So yeah, we're forced to try and understand the role of this book, really, in Dee's life, and what his obsession with this book tells us about his life. A book that is at once both concerned with purely with codes and also concerned with very strange magical concepts, with very esoteric concepts.
I imagine he kept this in the internal part of his library, his sanctum sanctorum.
This was definitely an interlibrary product here. Now, according to contemporary cryptologist Simon Singh, it's important to note here that encryption had been around for a while. He particularly mentions that Al-Kindi book that I mentioned earlier. In the simplest forms, encryption is about swapping letters for symbols and the use of frequency analysis to break it. And by the Elizabethan era, cryptography was already getting a bit more advanced. This was, again, a time of plots, espionage, deep political intrigue, and encryption was an important tool. Code making and code breaking was very much a part of the actual Game of Thrones of the day.
Mm-hmm.
One example that Singh throws out is just consider the intrigue surrounding Mary, Queen of Scots. She wanted to take the English throne, so Elizabeth imprisoned her. But she used, Mary used coded messages that she sent out to her co-conspirators, looking to work with the Spanish to put her on the throne instead of Elizabeth. Chief codebreaker Thomas Phillips, this is Elizabeth's codebreaker, came along. He broke this code she was using, and he broke it easily because she was using an outdated, simple form of cipher. So Mary was found out. She was tried. She was executed in 1587. So this serves as an example that codes, the making of the use of codes and the breaking of them, was life and death.
Yeah, especially when you consider like how much of this story that we've already told has involved political actors traveling around Europe, suspected of being spies, but, you know, basically just saying like either like, oh, I'm just here to see the sights, or I'm here to scry crystals and talk to angels or whatever, right? So code and cryptography would be essential to them passing messages back and forth, either from their home countries or to their associates in these other empires.
That's right. So we're about to take another break. But as we take the break, think to yourself, which is better? As you're out traveling around continental Europe,
yeah,
to be found out and accused as a spy or a magician, which is the more dangerous scenario?
Mm.
Hey, everybody, with the holidays almost here, you don't have time to go to the post office. There's traffic. There's parking. It's going to be packed with everyone mailing holiday gifts and packages. So you need to do what we do here at How Stuff Works. You need to use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, you can avoid all the hassle of going to the post office during the busy holiday season. Everything you can do from the post office, you can do right from your desk. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. Print postage for any letter or package the instant you need it. Then just mail it. Give it to the mail person. They'll pick it right up. It's easy and convenient. We use Stamps.com here at How Stuff Works. We need to send out the odd bit of merch or correspondence, and we want you to try it as well. So right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code STUFF, S-T-U-F-F, for this special offer. You'll get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in STUFF. That's Stamps.com, enter STUFF, and start mailing things. Thanks. All right, we're back.
Okay, so we asked which was better, to be accused of being a spy at the time or a magician. Now, given what we know about how many people accepted, quote, magic as being a part of, not, I wouldn't say daily life, but like the sciences, probably being accused of being a spy was worse.
I think there's less ambiguity, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because can you imagine you're accused of, oh, you're trying to speak to angels and you have all this angelic language. You know, depending on, some individuals would certainly be very quick to condemn you and say, well, you're practicing horrible magic and this is bad. But it seems like you have a certain amount of wiggle room there.
Yeah, well, I mean, consider Dee's own case, right? He goes to the Holy Roman Emperor and he says, angels told me you're possessed by demons. And the guy was like, eh, whatever. But then they think, he might be a spy. I'll kick him out of the country.
Yeah, at least, right? I mean, or throw him into a dungeon, execute him, etc.
Yeah.
So that's the question that one raises here. was John Dee a spy? The answer kind of varies, because it seems undoubtedly he played a role in introducing some concepts in cryptography to his Elizabethan masters.
He had a great cover story.
Yeah, he did. A cover story. That's the other thing. To what extent is this a guy who ended up buying into his cover story? Like, he went so deep cover that he himself had vast difficulties reemerging and returning to Elizabethan England. It's difficult to piece it together, because we have a guy here who seems to have been a pretty serious Christian, but he was also engaged in all of this, these occult interests. We have a guy who believed mathematics was the key to unlocking the secrets of the universe, who studied cryptography, who advised Queen Elizabeth I, who traveled rather extensively throughout Europe during a time of plots, political unrest, and war. And so, yeah, this has led some historians to ponder whether, well, not really whether, but to what degree John Dee was engaged in the espionage of the day.
Mm-hmm.
As early as the 17th century, English polymath Robert Hooke suggested that Dee's Book of the Spirits was actually a book of code rather than an account of angelic conversations.
Okay.
And that it would be, to go back to our previous question, that it would be far better to be charged with being a, quote, pretend enthusiast rather than a real spy.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I'm starting to lean more and more towards that as a theory.
Here's another interesting tidbit. Following Dee's copying of the Steganographia in 1563, he certainly wrote to William Cecil. That's Queen Elizabeth's key minister at the time, and who was just beginning to put in place the espionage network that under his predecessor, the spy master Francis Walsingham, would become one of the most formidable and effective spy systems, espionage systems in Europe.
So we're talking about the origins of MI6, basically.
Basically, yeah. Like, he wrote, in writing to Cecil, he's writing to one of two key individuals, and laying the groundwork for a vast network of spies, a vast coded network of spies. It depended on codes. Dee wrote to Cecil, apparently with great enthusiasm, telling him that this book was, quote, the most precious jewel that I have yet of other men's travails recovered, and that it would benefit, quote, the advancement of good letters and wonderful divine and secret sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So Benjamin Woolley, in his book, notes that Cecil was a very practical, conservative sort of fellow, and not the kind of guy to put a lot of stock in occult rituals. He was religious. He probably believed in spirits, you know, in kind of an abstract sense of the word, but he wasn't going to go rattling off a list of angel names or anything. So the secret sciences that we're talking about here might very well refer to interest far more earthly, far more espionage related than anything to do with, you know, angelic communication.
So maybe Dee was duping Kelly.
Yeah.
Like, he used a known occultist, alchemist, criminal as his companion for 10 years, possibly so that he could travel around and pretend like he was doing these rituals, when in fact he was up to something a little bit more concrete.
Yeah, it's, I think one of the difficult things in trying to figure out someone like Dee is we kind of look for this, not a simple interpretation, but we want a solid interpretation. And I guess the way I keep trying to make sense of it is to think, all right, every one of us has a fairly complex worldview, a lot of contradictions, we believe in various ideas simultaneously, even though they don't match up. And we all have, you know, I'm just going to generalize here, and let's say we all have very fairly normal brains.
Mm-hmm.
And Dee had an abnormal brain. Dee was a brilliant man, one of the most brilliant men of his day. And therefore, perhaps his contradictions were just that much greater, that much stranger, that much more out of proportion to what the rest of us live with.
Yeah, I think I can see where you're going with this, that there's a little bit of truth to all of this.
Yeah, that's where I keep coming back to, because it's tempting to say, oh, well, he was only in it for the codes.
Right.
He was a spy the whole time. He wasn't duped by this weird Edward Kelly character. He was the secret master the whole time. But as Woolley writes, Dee didn't see the steganographia as a purely diplomatic or political tool. Like, based on his writings, he clearly considered it to have far more esoteric uses. He believed that the cryptography could help him decipher other ancient texts, such as the Book of Soiga, an anonymous tome that he believed to have been written in the Enochian language. And another was a book that was attributed to Roger Bacon, the Voynich manuscript.
Oh, yeah.
Which is still yet to be deciphered.
Yeah, Voynich manuscript is something that comes up a lot around here. I know several of our other shows here have done episodes on it, and mm-hmm. How Stuff Works has like a pretty long Voynich manuscript article, I think, as well. So maybe Dee, then he's playing all sides for his own interests, you know,
like
he believes in the angel stuff, but he's also playing it out for this code stuff. He has interests in mathematics, in discovering the origins of the universe, in bettering the English Empire, and all of those coincide with talking to angels and spycraft and assisting trade agencies and being a courtier to the queen. It's alien to us from present day perspective. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it does seem to be the case that it was all connected to him. Yeah. This was the world that he lived in. He lived in a world in which, the British Empire had great things ahead of it, that things were cosmically aligned for it, that he himself was kind of the second coming of Merlin, that mathematics was the key to understanding and manipulating the forces in the world around him, and that you could use some of these properties to communicate with essentially extra-dimensional beings.
Yeah, who would reveal the secrets of science to you.
Yeah.
It's not like he was looking to cast fireballs and lightning bolts. He just wanted to know how the world worked.
Yeah, he was endlessly curious.
Huh.
And that's John Dee, the good doctor.
So, you know, he's got this reputation now that's endured as an astrologer and a magician. But I think, you know, what we should get out of these two episodes should be remembered that Dee was an accomplished mathematician, and he influenced the field as well as physics, music, philosophy, optical theory, and mechanical engineering. I mean, he really, Robert and I were talking about this outside of the studio. I mean, he was very influential in the history of the world in a lot of ways. We remember him as being this deluded guy who could talk to angels, but he contributed to European intellectual history. There's actually an organization called the John Dee Society that I found in my searching around. It's an organization dedicated to producing standard editions of his work, and they're trying to reconstruct his library. So they're assembling an archive of this material as they find it on microfilm, although I imagine that they're probably scanning it in digitally at this point. And I'd like to leave us with a quote from one of the books that I was consulting by R.W. Barron. It's called A Reputation History of John Dee, The Life of an Elizabethan Intellectual. And he says, 4 centuries after his death, we are still debating and wrestling with where Dee's work fits into the Elizabethan world picture and what contributions, if any, he made to those intellectual advancements. So there we have it. I mean, he's a fascinating fellow. He seems to have influenced our sciences. He's perfect for stuff to blow your mind. You know, he's got a little bit of the weirdness, the bizarre, bringing it into his understanding of the world, bringing wonder to these things, mm-hmm. and then simultaneously using things that we now consider everyday, like optics or cartography or just basic math, in the same respect.
Yeah, and it's just amazing that he's one of these guys that we know a fair amount about.
Yeah,
and yet the more you read about him, the more you just ask who was this guy? You know, was he really, like, what was the world he saw when he looked out the window? You know, and Yeah, he's just an amazing character. So it's been a great pleasure to research him and discuss him here on the podcast.
Yeah, I, for one, next time I'm in London, I am definitely going to go to the British Museum and try to get a look at some of those occult artifacts. And I'd really like to visit the site of Mortlake.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Kind of see what it's like, too. From looking at Google Maps, it doesn't seem like it's that far southwest of London. So, hey, anybody out there, have you been there? Have you seen this stuff in the British Museum? Maybe you know, like I said at the top of all of this, there's so much research into John Dee that maybe, you know, there's stuff that we don't know about that we missed here. Maybe there's something you'd like to add that we could read in a future listener mail episode. You can hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram. And don't forget to visit stufftoblowyourmind.com, which is our landing site where we'll have images that accompany this episode, as well as all of the blog posts and all of the videos and all the other podcasts that we do here.
Oh, and real quick, on a personal note, I just want to thank my cousin, Father Bede Price, for suggesting research into Dee's life and studies.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
This was really a pleasure.
All right. So if you want to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way, put aside the your various scrying instruments, put aside the magic mirror, and just simply send us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.